Welcome to another Salvation by Grace midweek message. Salvation by Grace is the teaching ministry of Grace Christian Assembly, a Sovereign Grace Fellowship in Smyrna, Tennessee. You'll find us on the internet at salvationbygrace.org. We are currently studying the minor prophets of the Old Testament. So grab your Bible and join the congregation of GCA, along with our teaching pastor, Jim McClarty.
Let's start tonight with Jim being ornery. So for many years here at GCA, we have spent time in the Old Testament. We have taught verse by verse all the way through the Pentateuch. We've covered the vast majority of the writings, although there are still some Psalms to cover. And we've been working our way through the prophets. We refer to the prophets a lot. Hopefully by now you have picked up the theme of the prophets. I know I say frequently that they speak with one voice when they talk about a future for Israel. In the Deuteronomical law, the second telling of the law, the Deuteronomos, it's the second telling of the law. In it, there is a test of the prophets that God gave. It was, if a prophet says something and it comes true, then he's a true prophet. If he says something and it doesn't come true, he's not a true prophet and you don't need to be afraid of him. And so I spent a lot of time pointing out the things that the prophets have said that have actually occurred. And I spend a lot of time demonstrating how they have occurred, that they have occurred literally, genuinely, physically, often geographically, in time and history. The prophets are given credibility by Jesus and the New Testament writers who quote from the prophets in order to validate that those prophecies are true. And when it comes to the things that have already occurred in history, people are willing to admit, yes, the prophets, we like the prophets. The prophets have said things and predicted things that came true. But universally, across the board, all of the prophets talk about a future for Israel. And so whenever we talk about that, I point out that the things that have actually happened give credibility and validity to the idea that the things that haven't happened yet definitely have to happen, that Israel does have to be regathered. They do have to be planted back in their own land. David's greater son is going to rule over them. The blessings from God are going to come down to Jerusalem and then flow out to the nations. All of that stuff that hasn't occurred yet has to happen. Are we agreed so far?
Yes.
So then what do we make of the many eschatologies and theologies out there, the many YouTube preachers you can find out there, who say that God is done with Israel and that he's not going to do those things? How do you fit that with God's test of a prophet? Because if you're going to deny things that the prophets have actually said, like the fact that they universally say that Israel's going to be regathered, if you deny that that's actually going to happen, isn't that tantamount to saying that the Old Testament prophets are false prophets? Because they have said things that aren't going to come true. I've had several correspondents lately ask me whether or not I believe in a future for Israel, which I absolutely do. And then they repeat back to me allegories, spiritualization, and in the end, lack of knowledge or just disputing what the Bible says. Because I write to them and I say things like what we're going to read tonight. We're starting the book of Micah tonight. In Micah, there's three big sections. In each of those sections, Micah holds Israel guilty and tells them why it is that God is going to punish them, why he's going to take them into the Assyrian captivity, why ultimately they're going into the Babylonian captivity. And yet each of those three big sections ends with promises of regathering, promises of God doing all the things that he promised to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. And so when we quote that kind of stuff, when I quote that kind of stuff back to people and say, but what do you do about this? It is distressing the amount of just general denial of what the Bible plainly says and what the prophets plainly say. And that worries me, that frightens me for them, because I think, well, then are you saying, based on the standard of Deuteronomy, are you saying that the prophets of the Old Testament, who Jesus and the New Testament writers validate, are you saying they are false prophets? Otherwise, if you're going to say they're true prophets, then you have to say exactly what we read this past Sunday from Isaiah, when God threw down the gauntlet and said, no one else can tell you in advance what's going to happen, and no one else can explain the past to you. I'm the only one who can do that, and therefore you have to say, yes, it's true. And if you're serious about the Bible, the only option you have is to come away with the conclusion, yes, it's true. Because the denial of a future for Israel, to put a very fine point on this, is a denial that the Old Testament prophets were actually valid prophets. And that is a huge theological dilemma that I don't think people give enough validity to or enough credit to. If they are indeed genuine prophets like Jesus and the New Testament authors say they are, then everything they said has to come true, including the promises of punishment for Israel, but also the time of restitution and regathering for Israel. And I want to say one more time what I said on Sunday and put it in this context of the minor prophets, which is that the people who are denying Israel now are talking about, well, you know, Israel today is kind of more of a geopolitical nation than they are the people of God, and that they deny Christianity and they've denied their Savior, they killed their Messiah, they're not good people, they're blasphemers, they spit on Christians. I hear that one a lot these days. And so, therefore, they can't be saved. And my question on Sunday was, when were they ever good? Because we're going to see it again tonight out of Micah, where God is going to say, you're really bad people, and I'm going to save you. Because that's the way God always works. The entirety of the Bible, Old and New Testament, is the story of redemption. And the reason that God is in the enterprise of redeeming people is because people need to be redeemed. Because there just are no good people. That's what the Bible says, and it's certainly what we believe about complete or total depravity, complete inability on the part of human beings. We believe that nobody is any good. Certainly that's what Paul argues. There's none that does good. No, not one. So people need to be redeemed, and people celebrate when they say, well, God has redeemed me. I was a poor, miserable sinner, and he redeemed me. But Israel, they're poor, miserable sinners, and that's why he can't redeem them, despite the fact that they have constant, continuous attestation all the way through the Old Testament. All the prophets speak with one voice and say that God is going to redeem and gather and save Israel. And if you don't say that, you're saying the prophets of the Old Testament are false prophets. All right. Micah. Micah is an early writing prophet. Micah is a contemporary of Isaiah. The name Micah is a shortened form of the word Micaiah, which really means, who is like Yahweh? Actually, the earliest attestation of Micah as a prophet doesn't come from the New Testament. It comes from Jeremiah, a later prophet who quotes from Micah. Jeremiah 26, starting at verse 12, says, Then Jeremiah spoke to all the officials and to all the people, saying, "The Lord sent me to prophesy against this house, against the house of Judah, and against this city, Jerusalem, all these words that you have heard." And of course, as you may recall, as we went through the book of Jeremiah, they were not happy about the things that he was saying, because he was the only of the prophets who was actually saying that God was going to condemn Israel, while all the other false prophets were saying, "No, no, you're good. Don't worry about it. God would never do that to you." So Jeremiah stood alone, and as I like to point out, he prophesied for 30 years and never really had a convert. And so here he is defending himself, starting in verse 13. "Now therefore, change your ways, amend your ways and your deeds, and obey the voice of Yahweh your God, and the Lord will change his mind about the misfortune which he has pronounced against you. But as for me, behold, I am in your hands. Do with me as is good and right in your sight. Only know for certain that if you put me to death, you will bring innocent blood on yourself and on this city and on its inhabitants. For truly Yahweh has sent me to you to speak all these words in your hearing." So then the officials and all the people said to the priests and to the prophets, "No death sentence for this man, for he has spoken to us in the name of Yahweh our God." Then some of the elders of the land rose up and spoke to all the assembly of the people, saying, "Micah from Moresheth," you're going to find out as we start the book of Micah that that's the same guy, that's where he's from. The very first verse of the book of Micah says, "The word of the Lord which came to Micah of Moresheth." So there's no question that Jeremiah at this point is quoting Micah, which means that Micah had to be written prior to Jeremiah. "Micah of Moresheth prophesied in the days of Hezekiah, king of Judah." Well, that's the same thing that we read at the top of the book of Micah. "The word of the Lord which came to Micah of Moresheth in the days of Jotham, Ahaz, and Hezekiah, kings of Judah, which he saw concerning Samaria and Jerusalem." So Jeremiah is familiar with the writings and the prophecies, and even when these prophecies came about, so he confirms that Micah was a contemporary of Isaiah. They were both prophesying at the same time period. "Micah of Moresheth prophesied in the days of Hezekiah, king of Judah, and he spoke to all the people of Judah, saying, 'Thus the Lord of hosts has said, Zion will be plowed as a field, and Jerusalem will come to ruins, and the mountain of the house of the high places will be like a forest.'" Now, did Hezekiah, the king of Judah, and all of Judah put him to death? Or did they not fear the Lord and entreat the favor of Yahweh, and the Lord changed his mind about the misfortune which he had pronounced against them? But are we committing a greater evil against ourselves? So that seemed to be a pretty good argument. And as you may recall, they relented. So Micah was from Moresheth, which is a Judean town about 25 miles southwest of Jerusalem. Now, historically, at this point, this is after the division of the northern and the southern tribes. This is after the time of Solomon and Solomon's sons splitting the kingdom. Like Isaiah, Micah prophesied about the Assyrian destruction of the northern kingdom, and then later, the fact that the southern kingdom was going to fall to the Babylonians. Micah prophesied during the reigns, as I just said, of Jotham, Ahaz, and Hezekiah, which places him in the 8th century BC, probably around the time of 750 to 686 BC. Now, like I said, the book has three big messages. We're going to try to cover as much as we can of the first message. The first message takes up the first two chapters, And the first message is all bad news. It starts with God is against you, and he's bringing the Assyrians against you, and you deserve it. Look at the end of chapter 2 for just a moment. The very end of chapter 2, starting at verse 12, after all that bad news, I will surely assemble all of you, Jacob. I will surely gather the remnant of Israel. I will put them together like sheep in the fold, like a flock in the midst of its pasture. And they will be noisy with men. So they're going to be a great multitude. That's very in keeping with what we have seen from the other prophets, that God is going to make them a greater number of people than they were initially. Verse 13, the breaker, or the one who breaks through. This is a reference to God who is going to break through all of the guilt and everything that would keep them away from God. The breaker goes up before them, and they break out, and they pass through the gate, and they go out by it. In other words, they're going to live in Jerusalem, and their gates are going to be opened. So their king goes on before them, and the Lord is going to be at their head. Yahweh is going to be at their head. This is after two chapters of really, really bad news. All I'm trying to demonstrate is that Micah, just like all the other prophets, major and minor, all end up saying, but God's going to restore you. Despite the fact that he's going to punish you, he's going to restore you. And that same pattern, that exact same pattern, is what we see in the book of Daniel and the book of Revelation. The book of Revelation itself talks about the time of trouble that we've been reading about in Matthew 24, this time of trouble such as never was or ever would be again. Okay, you're going to be punished. But then it culminates in Christ coming back and sending out his angels with a great trumpet and gathering his elect from the north and the south and the east and the west and bringing them back exactly like the prophets have all said they're going to do. So the message doesn't change. Old or New Testament, what you see is that God is going to punish Israel, and then he's going to regather Israel. Have I bored anybody yet?
No.
I just want you to see the big theme of the Bible. And the big theme of all the prophets, carrying all the way to the book of Revelation, that theme doesn't change. It's so very consistent. The only place it changes is in the minds of creative theologians who end up denying what it actually says over and over and over and over again. If you just read the Bible, it's very plain what God's plan is. It's unquestionable. To deny it, you have to go to like a seminary or something. You have to be taught it, because you're not going to get it from the Bible. It has to be imported and then imposed on the Bible. Micah stresses judgment and he stresses restoration. Big portions of Micah are Hebrew poetry. Hebrew poetry is very different than modern American or English poetry. We think in terms of rhyme schemes, rhythms. Jewish Hebrew poetry usually has to do with parallelism, saying things a couple of different ways. And Micah engages in that. And in fact, he engages in a lot of wordplay that we're even going to see in the first chapter. Now, Micah is also quoted twice in the New Testament. For instance, in Matthew 2:4, you should know this. This is when Herod was asking where the Christ child was going to be born, the king of Israel. So gathering together all the chief priests and the scribes of the people, he inquired of them where the Messiah was to be born. And they said to him, in Bethlehem of Judea, for this is what is written by the prophet. The prophet they're speaking of is Micah. It's written, and you, Bethlehem, land of Judah, are by no means least among the leaders of Judah, for out of you shall come forth a ruler who will be the shepherd of my people Israel. By the way, notice that language. Even that prediction was there's going to be a Christ who's going to come, the Messiah is going to come, and he's going to be the ruler and the shepherd over my people Israel. That's very consistent with what all the prophets have said and consistent with the idea of the regathering of Israel and Christ on David's throne. The second place where Micah is quoted, also in the book of Matthew, is in Matthew 10:34, and this is in a negative context, where it says, "Do not think that I came to bring peace on the earth." This is Jesus talking. "I did not come to bring peace, but a sword, for I came," and now he's quoting from Micah 7:6, "for I came to set a man against his father and a daughter against her mother, and a daughter-in-law against her mother-in-law, and a man's enemies will be members of his own household." So Jesus even quoted from Micah, which means that Jesus gives attestation to the validity of Micah. Now, if Jesus gave validity to the prophecies of Micah, did he only give partial validity? Like all that stuff about Israel being punished, that's all valid. But all that stuff that Micah said about the regathering of Israel, no longer valid. Do you get my point? I know I'm just going to keep hammering away at this. But if you're going to be biblically consistent and not end up saying that Old Testament prophets are false prophets, you have to end up saying they all say the same thing, the same story, and that story is God's commitment to his people Israel, because he calls himself the Redeemer of Israel, he calls himself the God of Israel, he calls himself the Savior of Israel. It certainly sounds, based on what all the prophets have said and the names that God gives himself, it certainly sounds like he intends to regather and redeem Israel. So what are we going to say about that? And to my way of thinking, there's far too much of it. It is said too often in too many places to successfully allegorize or successfully dismiss. At some point, as Christian Bible-believing people, we have to stand toe-to-toe with it and say, well, that's what it says. All right, so let's start reading out of the book of Micah. Now, when we get to verses 10 through 16, Micah's going to make reference to many of the cities of Israel and even down into Judah. And he uses a bit of wordplay, and several commentators have mentioned this language wordplay that Micah engages in. Some of it I find funny and compelling. Some of it, I think, is stretching a point because, as you know, with the Hebrew language, since there are no vowels, there's just a series of consonants, many words sound like other words. But there are some that are just obvious that I find kind of humorous. For instance, Micah told the people of Beth Ophrah, which means the house of dust, to roll in the dust. Okay, now that's not a mistake. He used the same word, and he's saying, you need to repent. You're the house of dust. Get down in the dust. So that kind of wordplay we're going to look at as we go through this. The word of the Lord, which came to Micah of Moresheth in the days of Jotham, Ahaz, and Hezekiah, kings of Judah, which he saw concerning Samaria and Jerusalem. Samaria, capital of the northern kingdom. Jerusalem, capital of the southern kingdom. So hear, O peoples, all of you. Listen, O earth, and all that it contains. And let the Lord God be a witness against you, the Lord from his holy temple. For behold, the Lord is coming forth from his place, from his holy temple, and he will come down and tread on the high places of the earth, the mountains. So he's going to come down to the mountains. Now, this harkens back to what happened when the children of Israel were brought out of Egypt, and on their way to the promised land, they came to Mount Sinai. And as you may recall, God came down onto the high places, onto the top of the mountain, and it was very frightening. And there were thunders and lightnings and a loud roaring voice. But the good news was God was establishing them as a people group, as a community people, as a country, and he was giving them his law. It was actually a good meeting between the two of them. By contrast, Micah picks up that same kind of description and says God's going to once again come down from his holy place, and he's going to come down onto the top of the mountains, down onto the top of the high places, but this time he's coming back angry. This time he's coming back in judgment. This time he's not coming to help you. This time he's coming to judge you. For behold, the Lord is coming forth from his place and will come down and tread on the high places of the earth, and the mountains will melt under him, and the valleys will be split like wax before a fire, like water poured down from a steep place. In other words, as God comes down, as his wrath and his judgment come down, it's just going to pour over the earth. All this is because of the rebellion of Jacob and for the sins of the house of Israel. What is the rebellion of Jacob? Is it not Samaria? So Jacob, the northern tribes, their capital has become a place of corruption and chasing after other gods. That is the very seat of rebellion. And what is the high place of Judah? Is it not Jerusalem? For I will make Samaria a heap of ruins in the open country, planting places for a vineyard. And I will pour her stones down into the valley. And I will lay bare her foundations, and all of her idols will be smashed. All of her earnings, all her ill-gotten gain, all that she's gotten by trading with the surrounding nations and the Gentiles and chasing after their gods, all their earnings, the stuff that they trusted in, their riches, their wealth, their gold, will all be burned with fire. And all of her images, just like all her idols, I will make desolate. For she collected those, the images, the idols, and the earnings. She collected those from a harlot's earning. That should be familiar language now. Again, he's using language that the prophets use across the board, whether we're talking about Hosea marrying Gomer as a demonstration of the fact that Israel has chased after a harlot, or whether we're talking about the language that Ezekiel uses, which is very graphic language about the harlotries that have been committed by Israel. Here Micah says the same things. Everything that they've enriched themselves with, they got because of the harlotries that they engaged in with the surrounding Gentile nations, chasing after their gods, building their idols. For she collected them from a harlot's earnings, and to the earnings of a harlot they will return. And because of this is now Micah speaking, because this is all going to happen, because God is coming in judgment, because Assyria and Jerusalem are going to be punished, and because they have turned against God and chased their idols and become rich on the back of their harlotries, because of all that, Micah says, I must lament and I must wail. In other words, I have to say this. I have to go and tell you about this. In chapter 2, the people are going to say to him, very much like they said to Jeremiah, they're going to say to him, don't talk like that anymore. In fact, the specific language is don't foam at the mouth. The Hebrew implication is that you're babbling, you're making stuff up. Don't say these things anymore. Don't speak out. Don't foam at the mouth. And here he is saying, because of what's happening, I have to. I must lament. I must wail. I must go barefoot and naked. I must make a lament like the jackals. The jackals would get out there and howl at night and cry out. And he says, that's what my crying out has to be like. And of course, ostriches make those low noises that sound like they're mourning. And he says, I'm going to mourn like the ostriches do. For her wound, Israel's wound, is incurable. Really interesting, because that is also language that the other prophets use, which is why it's so important that when we understand Isaiah saying, and by his stripes we are healed, he was talking to Israel in specific and not talking about just your sicknesses are going to be healed, the way that so many Pentecostals understand it, by his stripes we are healed. But instead, nationally, they are nationally wounded. They are nationally sick. They are nationally depraved. And by the wounds of Christ, Israel will be redeemed. They will be made whole again because of the stripes that Jesus took. So he says here, for her wound is incurable by any human methodology, by any deals they'd make with Gentiles. There's nothing they can do about it. They're wounded and God is going to pay them. And that wound of Israel, the northern tribe, has come to Judah. And it has reached the gate of my people, even to Jerusalem. We've talked about this before, that the armies of Sennacherib, the armies of Assyria, conquered the northern tribes and came as far down as the very gates of Jerusalem. They stood at the gates of Jerusalem, and in one night, God sent an angel that pretty much wiped out the army. He protected Jerusalem, but then he is later going to deliver Jerusalem to the Babylonian captivity. Micah got it 100% right. Not only is Israel going to suffer under the hand of the Assyrians, who God is going to bring down on them, but that is going to come even to Jerusalem, to the gate of my people in Jerusalem. So then what are you going to do about it? Tell it not in Gath, weep not at all. In other words, there's going to be nobody to spread this news. And don't tell city by city that it happened to some other city, because it's going to happen to all of them. Across the board, they are all going to suffer. At Beth-la-Afra, roll yourself in the dust. As I said, that's the house of dust. So roll yourself in the dust. And go your way, inhabitant of Shafir. In a shameful nakedness. That's really interesting. Shafir means pleasantness, beauty. So they take great pride in the fact that they've decorated themselves. And yet he says the end result of you is that you're going to be shameful and naked. And the inhabitant of Za'anan will not escape. Za'anan, it means going out. And one of the ironic things about Za'anan was that they believed in the walls of their city and their gates. And for the most part, they wouldn't go outside their city or outside their gates. And here is Micah saying, oh, you're going out this time. Yeah, you'll be leaving this time because you're not going to escape. And the lamentation of Beth Ezel, which means the house of removal, the lamentation of Beth Ezel, and he will take from you your support. You might believe in your walls, you might believe in your armies, you might believe in your horses, but God's going to remove all of that and give Assyria an easy way to conquer you. For the inhabitant of Meroth will become weak, waiting for good. The word Meroth in the Hebrew is very much like the word for bitterness, and so there seems to be a connection there, that they are going to weep bitterly and become weak, waiting for something good to happen for them, because a calamity has come down from Yahweh to the gate of Jerusalem. Lachish, by the way, was known for their horses, and this is really interesting. Even the name Lachish is the same phonetics, the same lettering, as a team of horses. And so harness the chariot to the team of horses, O inhabitant of Lachish. Why? Because she was the beginning of the sin to the daughters of Zion. So apparently the beginnings, the early rumblings of following after foreign gods and turning away from Yahweh, the God of Israel, seems to have begun in the area of Lachish. God is certainly holding them accountable for that. Because in you were found the rebellious acts of Israel. Therefore, you will, I think that's a reference to Lachish, you will give parting gifts on behalf of Moresheth Gath. parting gifts there is actually like dowry. It's the gifts that a father would give when his daughter was married. So it was gifts that you would give your daughter as she was leaving the house, as she was going away, as she was departing. So he's saying, after Lachish, the next one that's going to go down is Moresheth-Gath. You're going to give her parting gifts. Bye. You're also going to be destroyed. So the houses of Achzib will become a deception. Achzib means a dried up riverbed, a dried up stream, which, by the way, is a deception. If you go to where you know the stream is because you need water and you get there and it's all dried up, well, you've been deceived. But they are also going to deceive Israel itself, apparently because of their destruction. They're not going to be able to add to the army. They're not going to be able to send men to fight. And so they're going to become a deception to the kings of Israel. And moreover, I will bring on you the Assyrians. I will bring on you the one who takes possession of you, O inhabitant of Marishah. The glory of Israel will enter Adullam. The only other place that you might know Adullam is when David had to run for his own life, and he hid in the caves of Adullam. Well, that seems to be the implication here. The leaders in Israel, the powerful in Israel, the kings, the princes in Israel, because of the destruction that's coming, they're going to have to run. They're going to have to hide themselves. They're going to go to the caves of Adullam and hide themselves. Make yourselves bald. That's a sign of grieving. Shave off your hair. Cut off your hair because of the children of your delight. Even the children are going to be spared. And so there's going to be this grieving among the men and the women of Israel as the children of their own delight are taken into captivity or killed and destroyed. Because of the children of your delight, extend your baldness like an eagle, and they will go from you into exile. And then Micah turns his attention to the ones, the high and the mighty. This is a common theme among the prophets, that the people who had the power, who had the money, the unjust judges, the people with unjust scales, that they would cheat the people who had nothing because they knew that the people who had nothing couldn't do anything to them. And so this injustice among brethren is a common theme of God's reason for punishing Israel. So Micah turns his attention to that. Woe to you who scheme, who plan iniquity, who work out evil on their beds, and then when the morning comes, they do it. And it is in the power of their hands. In other words, they not only think about it, but they have the capability of doing it. And what do? Verse 2, they covet fields, and then they seize them. And they covet houses, and then they take them. They rob a man and his house. They rob a man of his inheritance. If you take a field, if you take land, that is an inheritance given by God to families. And if you take a man's house and his property, then you've robbed him of his inheritance. Therefore, thus says Yahweh, behold, I am planning against this family, this whole group. I am planning a calamity from which you cannot remove your necks. And you will not walk with your nose in the air. You won't walk proudly. You won't walk haughty, because I'm going to force you to put your head down. And you will not walk haughtily, for it will be an evil time. That's ra'ah. That's that word for trouble. It's going to be a troublesome time. On that day, they, the ones I'm bringing down on you, will take up against you a taunt, and they will utter a bitter lamentation and say, now apparently the and say is, this is going to be your response. You're going to agree with them in the lamentation and the taunting that they bring to you. You're going to say, we are completely destroyed. He exchanges the portion of my people and how he removes it from me. And to the apostate, to ones who aren't even Israelites, to ones who aren't even Jewish, to the apostate, he apportioned out our fields, our inheritance. That was our stuff. And now he's giving it to a different people group. Therefore, you'll have no one stretching a measuring line. You're not going to have any property anymore. You're not going to have anybody assessing where the property borders are. You're not going to be placing stones anymore to show where your properties are. Therefore, you will have no one stretching a measuring line for you by lot in the assembly of the Lord. One of the first things that happened when Israel got into the promised land is that God himself determined which pieces of property, which pieces of land were going to go to each tribe and then to each family group. And you couldn't take away that land. That's what the whole idea of the year of Jubilee was about. You could take loans, you could loan out your land, but on the year of Jubilee, it was all restored back to the way that God originally established it. But there's not going to be anybody to tell you where your line is. And there's not going to be anybody who's going to measure it out for you in the whole assembly. So do not, this is what I was talking about earlier, this is the response from the people when they hear this bad news coming from Micah. They say, don't speak out. Don't say stuff. And like I said, it's don't foam at the mouth. Don't say such crazy utterances. The irony is, Micah says, and so they foam from the mouth. They're the ones saying the crazy utterances because they're telling me not to say this stuff. But if they do not speak out concerning these things, reproaches will not be turned back. In other words, even if I don't get to say it out loud, this is going to happen. Even if you refuse to hear me or believe it, this is going to happen. Because this is the determination of God. So, is it being said, O house of Jacob, is the Spirit of the Lord impatient? In other words, they would say, but God is long-suffering. He'll put up with all this stuff that we've been doing. And he's saying, not forever. It's being said around the house of Jacob, is the Spirit of Yahweh impatient? Are these things his doing? Do not my words do good to the one who's walking uprightly? In other words, I'm telling you these things because you are guilty. I'm telling you these things because you are mistreating each other, because you are chasing idols, because you are to be judged. If you're walking uprightly, the things I'm saying to you would be favorable to you. And the reason I'm not saying favorable things to you is because of your own guilt. Do not my words do good to the one walking uprightly? Recently, my people have arisen as an enemy. In other words, God's saying, you're now an enemy to me, and now he describes to them their behavior that makes it obvious that they are enemies to him. You strip the robe off the garment from unsuspecting passersby. In other words, you rob people from those who are returning from war. The women of my people you evict. Each one from her pleasant house. From her children, you take my splendor forever. The things that I have given, the things that I have blessed them with, that's the stuff that you take to yourself. You rob them. You take their coats. You take their homes. You take their land. And you take it from generations of people. So arise and go, for this is no place of rest. Because of the uncleanness that brings on destruction and a painful destruction. If a man walking after the wind and falsehood has told lies and said, I will speak out to you concerning wine and liquor, well, he would be the spokesman to his people. This is Micah arguing his case. I'm telling you the truth. You're telling me to shut up. You're saying I'm just babbling. You're saying that I'm just foaming at the mouth because I'm mad. if you were righteous, I would have said good things to you. And now you're saying that if someone comes along who was full of wine and liquor and telling you stuff, you'd listen to him. As long as he's saying something good to you, you'll listen to him. Does any of this sound familiar? I mean, as long as somebody from a pulpit is saying good things, people will flock to that. People will listen to that. That's always been the nature of human beings. Just tickle my itching ears. Just tell me the things that I want to hear. Well, Micah says that's the case even in his day. If a man walking after wind and falsehood, he's a liar, he's not telling you the truth, and he's told lies, and he said, I will speak out to you concerning wine and liquor. In other words, you're going to have abundance. Everything's going to be fine. Well, then he would be the spokesman to this people. So given those two chapters, how guilty is Israel? Would you be willing to say they're as guilty then as they are now? Sure. Yeah. So then God's done with them, right? I mean, permanently done with them. Except that he wasn't done with them in Micah's day. And he wasn't done with them in any of the prophets' days. He wasn't done with them in Paul's day. And he wasn't done with them in John's day on the Isle of Patmos. He wasn't done with them according to Jesus. And instead, what we hear is, I will surely assemble all of you, Jacob. I mean, what a juxtaposition. An almost shocking turn of events. You're guilty, guilty, guilty. You're so guilty, I'm going to put you in the Assyrian captivity. One more point, really important point. He's talking to Israel, the northern tribes who were taken into the Assyrian captivity. Those are the people who he says, and I'm going to gather you, Jacob. So does it matter that we refer to them as lost tribes? No, because God knows where they are. He can find them. Just because you can't doesn't mean he can't. And those are the very people who were so guilty, he scattered them. And that's why it's so important that he says, I'll get them from the north, from the south, from the east, from the west. If they are at the very ends of the earth, I will go, I will get them. I will bring them back to the land of Israel, the land of Canaan. I'll bring them back to Jerusalem, and I'll bring them back to their king. I will surely assemble all of you, Jacob. I will surely gather the remnant of Israel. I will put them together like sheep in a fold. There's that sheep-shepherd analogy again, which is why Jesus comes to the planet and announces he's the great shepherd of the sheep and says he's sent to the lost sheep of the house of Israel. It's very consistent language. To understand who the lost sheep of the house of Israel are, you have to understand your Old Testament. You have to understand the prophets. I will put them together like sheep in a fold, like a flock in the midst of its own pasture, and they will be noisy with men. Why? Because the one who breaks through, the God who defends them, the one who's going to conquer their enemies and establish his will for them eternally, the breaker goes up before them, and that's why they break out. And they pass through the gate, and they go out by it. So their king goes on before them, and the Lord is at their head. Really interesting language by Micah to make a differentiation between the Lord, who is at the head, the one who guides them, the one who leads them, and the king who goes before them. A reference both to Yahweh and his ultimate king. So Micah is not saying anything that all the other prophets haven't said. He is continuing to confirm that story of redemption and God's determination to regather Israel. And Micah is the one who later in the same book is going to point at Christ and even say where he's going to be born and say that's how it's all going to happen. It's not because Israel's going to clean up and get good. It's not because Israel is going to turn from their evil ways, just like they haven't yet. But the way that they are going to ultimately be redeemed and reestablished is through Christ, which is exactly what we read in Matthew 24, that when he comes back, he's going to have the great trumpet, send out his angels, gather them from the north, south, east, west. The language is consistent. It's all the same story about a very consistent and gracious God who makes promises and makes unconditional covenants, and then can't nobody stop him when it's time for him to do exactly what he promised he was going to do. And I don't care what theology you have. And I don't care what eschatology you have. And I don't care how much you want to talk anti-Semitic about Israel right now. They are still the people who God said he's going to gather, and I got to be on God's side in that one. Hopefully, you'll be back next week to hear the next two chapters. And by the way, they're going to end the exact same way. They're guilty, and I'm going to regather them. You're going to get bored hearing that by the time this is over. But God is so repetitious with what he says, I don't know how people ignore it. Questions, comments, feedback, anything?
It's interesting that the things that we talk so much about here on Sunday is like, you know, kind of reiterating the same message that all the prophets have. Is we're starting to see it more and more being kind of talked in the mainstream. I was just listening to the great theologian Tucker Carlson. he was saying basically what we believe, that we're heretics, you know, saying that, you know, Christian Zionists, if you believe that God, the children of Israel, God's chosen people, then, you know, that's heresy, and the church has never believed that. And he said that Christian Zionists are the most detestable people. And he recently said that the Book of Esther, he cast aspersions on it. You know, should it even be in the Bible? And, you know, why is it even in there? And why are we seeing that all of a sudden? And, you know, it's becoming so much more popular. And it seems like
such a good question. And congratulations, really good question. But then again, the book is named after you. It's not just politics. It can't be. There's clearly a spiritual element to it. It's impossible to ignore anymore. When you see this kind of sweeping anti-Semitism again against the very people who God said, you're going to be hated without a cause. And then you see them hated without a cause, that is much more than just political disagreement. That is actual spiritual warfare taking place on the planet. And that's why the answers that people like Tucker Carlson give aren't satisfying, because he's looking at it strictly through human, political, fleshly kind of eyes and ignoring the fact that there is this whole history between Yahweh, the God of Israel, and the people of Israel. But the good news for us is, no matter how many people deny it, just like they were trying to tell Jeremiah to be quiet, just like they were telling Micah to be quiet, no matter how many people deny it, it's going to happen no matter what, because you're talking about the God who created everything, and he's still going to accomplish exactly what he said he's going to accomplish. But the spiritual element is being ignored by even great swaths of the confessing Christian church. And I think that's a huge mistake.
Yeah. But that's the only rational I can come up with. It doesn't seem...
But what a surprise. That there's this very spiritual element to it, and the very unspiritual, God-hating world doesn't get it. Right. There's no real surprise there.
No.
Yes, sir.
The man who married us was also a professor in the college we attended. And on several occasions, both in church and in class, I heard him say, if in a sandstorm on the planet Mars, a single grain of sand goes in a direction other than God decreed it to go, God immediately ceases to be God and the universe ceases to exist. And the other day I was reading something in some science page. It made me think, okay, he thinks too small, because they said there are more stars in this universe than there are grains of sand on the earth, which I can't begin to comprehend.
Yeah, who can?
But I also know that all of those stars, however many they are, God named them. And we think it's a task beyond his capability to bring the Jews back to their land.
Yeah. I think so frequently when I look at that stuff online, the phrase that keeps running through my head is, your God's too small. Yeah. You just have no idea how big God really is. But they imagine a God who waits around to see what you're going to do. And that's not the God of the Bible.
Thank you for listening to this week's Salvation by Grace midweek message. We encourage you to visit our website at salvationbygrace.org for books, articles, and our ever-expanding archive of audio sermons. And we invite you to join us next time when we gather around the Word and study the sovereign grace of God. Thank you.